Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Emma Southen, a historian and author. Her most recent book is called A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. This is episode CLVI, Agrippina, Mother of Nero. As the wife to the emperor and daughter of Germanicus, Agrippina had grown accustomed to being a voice of influence in Rome. This changed when her son Nero took the title, and she struggled to have her voice heard. Here's Emma Southen.
Nero becomes emperor, and Agrippina's role changes almost immediately. Like, within the week that he becomes emperor, you see a big shift in the way that she is able to operate. You first see it in a speech that Nero gives when he is being acclaimed emperor by the Senate, which was written by Seneca, where he says that the imperial household will no longer be an influence in his government. And that is a deliberate barb at people like Pallas, the freedman, and also at Agrippina, who has been a really strong influence. And it is Seneca saying through Nero that Agrippina is not going to be the figure in Nero's reign that she has been previously. She's not going to be a public representation of Nero's reign.
So Seneca essentially owes his position to Agrippina, who brought him back to oversee Nero's education. But this feels like a bit of maneuvering on his part to sideline her a bit.
Yeah.
Maybe he's looking out in Nero's best interests.
Quite possibly. He's very conservative. Agrippina's, one of her first acts is to bring him back from exile and to install him as Nero's tutor. And he is kind of a very strong Stoic philosopher. He writes all of this stuff about how feelings are bad and all of the ways in which you should be a good emperor, like on anger and things and on clemency. But he's very much a do as I say, not as I do kind of person. except in this case where he has a very conservative perspective on what an emperor should be and what the role of women within the imperial household should be. And it is that the emperor should be the first citizen of the Senate, and he should work in concert with the Senate, and his family should be at home, not having anything to do with that, which is a bit of a stab in the heart for Agrippina, who has given him his career and presumably hoped that he would then be on her side, and he is just not at all. It turns out that after all this time, he's actually been quite resenting everything that she does. And then there is this very dramatic scene fairly early on where there's trouble in Armenia again. There's always trouble in Armenia because Armenia is the border between the Parthian Empire and the Roman Empire, and they're always fighting to control it, like who gets whose client king in. And Parthians have invaded and knocked out the Roman client king, and the Roman client king turns up in Rome and says, help. And there are fears that there will be a woman in charge of this war, basically, that Agrippina will take charge because Nero is still only like 19. And so Seneca and Nero decide that they need to take a stand. And what happens is their Armenian delegation are prepared. Nero comes in, takes his seat, and then Agrippina comes in and goes to take her seat. And Seneca pushes Nero forward and says, get rid of her. And Nero in that moment has to make this decision as to whether he lets his mother sit next to him and have the same position that she had with Claudius, but more because she's his mother, or whether he sides with Seneca and says no. And he sides with Seneca, and he steps forward and turns his mother around and escorts her out of the room and says, you can't have this position, basically, which is enormously humiliating for her, but sets a standard for how Nero wants his reign to be, and really exemplifies how much of her position under Claudius had been under Claudius's dislike power. It had been his decision to let her sit next to him rather than her decision to sit next to him. He then, in what she takes as an immense insult, gives her a pretty dress to say sorry, which she is like, what the hell is this? When have I ever worn pretty dresses? Like, she's so offended. And this causes an enormous argument between the two of them. She is removed from the palace, which is like, that is the center of power. Like, the location where everything really happens is the palace. That's where people are going in and out of. That's where Nero sees everybody in the morning. And then they would also see Agrippina. And she's removed from the palace and sent to go and live somewhere else. And she's really humiliated and completely sidelined. And then, interestingly enough, people who she presumably thought were her friends, like Nero's paternal aunt, decide to try and get rid of her by accusing her of treason, which is quite fun. It starts with her allegedly snuggling up to Britannicus in order to spite Nero.
You mean figuratively snuggling up, though, don't
yes,
you?
Yes,
you
figuratively.
Because there are kind of, you know, Suetonius stories about Agrippina and Nero having it off in his litter. And
that's
sort of a very close kind of relationship.
But yeah, apparently she only fancied her actual sons, not her adoptive sons. No, so she starts making declarations. This is when Tacitus's version of Agrippina gets quite interesting, because she's really severe and unemotional and masculine, quote unquote, previously, but now she starts getting all of these like slightly hysterical speeches where she starts screeching and shouting. And there's a brilliant bit slightly later where she does her Bond villain speech where she declares all of the things that she's done.
She can overthrow him with a confession. It is I who made you emperor.
Yeah, exactly, that kind of thing. But she starts kind of grasping Britannicus, who is a 13-year-old boy who is presumably baffled by the whole affair, to her bosom and declaring that she's going to make him the next emperor. Nero poisons Britannicus, so that's the end of that. And then Domitilla comes forward and says that she is having an affair with a kind of distant cousin and she's going to make him the emperor. And there's quite a fun scene where they get an actor who is one of Nero's favourites to go into a party when Nero is already drunk and tell him this in the hope that he will, while drunk, have her executed like in the middle of the night. Like, he will just say, my God, she's plotting against me, have her executed, without thinking it through. And then he'll wake up the next morning and be like, oh my God, did I murder my mother?
As you do.
As you do. Which doesn't say much about what they think of Nero. What happens instead is Burrus, who is the Praetorian prefect, who is an eminently sensible man, he says, sleep on it. Go to bed. We'll talk to Agrippina in the morning. We'll see what's happening. If it turns out that it's true that she's plotting with this Regulus person, then we'll have a proper trial. So Nero goes off to bed. The next day, they talk to Agrippina. She goes in to talk to Nero. She manages to talk her way into having a conversation with Nero. And by the time that conversation is over, not only is she not going to be executed for treason, but she's managed to get loads of her friends new jobs. And
yeah,
she's moved back into the palace. Which I think is amazing. Like, she goes from literally a hair's breadth from being beheaded in the night to talking her way back into everybody's good books.
It'd be really interesting to know what she said.
I know, so wouldn't it be great? I suspect that she doesn't do the big speech that she does when she's confronted with this, where she does start waving her arms about and saying, I murdered all these people and I did all of this so that I could make him emperor, and, you know, laying out her plot from beginning to end. Which I suspect to Tacitus looks really terrible, but to a modern reader looks really cool. It looks like she was a real badass.
So how does it get to the point then when Nero decides he wants to do away with her? Is she just being too inconvenient in his reign?
Yes. After that big showdown, she vanishes from the sources completely for 5 years, which is a really long time. And it's not known where she is or what she's doing. Nero's reign is running reasonably smoothly and nothing terrible is happening, which doesn't last after she dies. So I suspect that she was around and about doing what she was doing for Claudius, but in a less public way. But after 5 years, he decides that he wants to divorce Octavia, who he doesn't like at all, and marry someone else. He wants to marry his friend's wife. It's Otho's wife. They're quite close friends. Otho's always boasting about how pretty his wife is. And then one day he brings her to dinner and Nero goes, oh yeah, she is really pretty. I'd quite like her actually. So he sends Otho off to be a governor and won't let him take his wife with him and then seduces her. He wants to marry her, but there's not a chance that Octavia is going to be okay with this. And there's not a chance that Agrippina is going to be okay with this. You don't marry for love. You marry because it's good optics and it's good for the family. This is the best indication that we have that Agrippina is still a powerful force in his reign, even though she's not in the sources anymore, because she's not causing the kind of trouble that makes historians write about it, Roman historians write about it. She's not dressing in gold cloaks and sitting next to him, but she's obviously still doing something and has a power over him, because otherwise he would just ignore her. Wanted. Yeah, yeah, he would just divorce Octavia, marry his new girlfriend and everybody whose name is Poppaea, and everybody would just get on with their life. And she might be a bit cross, but what's she going to do about it? It turns out potentially quite a lot. So he decides the only way that he can get what he wants is to kill his mother.
You get kind of three very, not completely contradictory accounts, but they all talk about the boat incident, I think. We've got Agrippina in Baiae.
Mm-hmm.
And Nero turns up and invites her to a dinner and is quite nice and happy with seeing her. And
yes, which makes her happy because it's clear that they have not had a great relationship. Like, they're not close anymore. They don't see each other very often. They are obviously not having regular dinners together. And there is this split between them, potentially because he's constantly talking about how he wants to kill her. Suetonius has two previous attempts, the poisoning attempt and one that doesn't make a lot of sense, where he tries to rig her bedroom ceiling collapse and kill her while she's sleeping and look like an accident. The reason that he wants this to look like an accident is that Burrus tells him that no one will ever execute the daughter of Germanicus unless they have a very, very, very good reason. And she is popular and she is still powerful and she has this heritage. So what he wants is for it to look like an accident so that everybody will feel very sorry for him and he can maintain the power and the prestige of his mother and her popularity and maybe make her a goddess and be terribly sad in public and also get rid of her.
So this brings us to the ship nicely, which is set up as an accident.
Yeah.
A so very elaborate to- one.
Yeah. So one of his friends comes up with this, claiming that he's seen it in a circus performance, and it is a ship that collapses somehow, like a trick ship. So he invites her to dinner. It's a festival of Minerva, I think. They have a lovely dinner. He kisses her. They have a lovely time. And then he says, but take my boat to go home, because they have two houses on opposite sides of the bay. Don't go overland. Take my boat. You'll be home quickly. It'll be lovely. And Tacitus has this kind of very idyllic scene of her and two of her friends lying on the deck in the lovely weather. And then all of a sudden, the boat somehow collapses. It either opens up in some way, or it one side collapses down, or the mast comes down in some way. It's really unclear what the hell happens. Mm. But it collapses and her companions are thrown into the water. And the plan is that they will drown. But it's a nice night. It's a fairly calm sea. And what Nero apparently doesn't know about his mother is that she is a very strong swimmer. Mm. My unprofessional theory is that when she was exiled on an island, which is very famous now for its lovely swimming, she did a lot of swimming.
That would make sense.
Yeah. She just swims away. One of her enslaved attendants tries to save her own life by shouting, help me, I'm the Augusta, and gets beaten to death with an oar. But Agrippina just swims to shore, walks home, and then sends a messenger to Nero to tell him what has happened. Because there's not a lot to do in the ancient world, a crowd starts forming outside of her house, because obviously a boat collapsing in the bay is kind of a drama.
A big news story around there at the time. Yeah.
And the Augusta was on it. So they're going to, they start crowding around her house to make sure she's okay. The messenger makes it to Nero. It's about 5 kilometers-ish between the two houses. So he's running backwards and forwards. He arrives at Nero's house and says, lads, there's been an accident, but everything's okay. Your mom's all right.
Oh, good. I'm just going to send these guys with some knives around to check on her.
Yeah, pretty much. Nero yeah. and his friend, a naval officer who really hates Agrippina for reasons unclear, kind of go off into a corner and have a bit of a chat. They ask Burrus if he'll go around and do something, and he says no. So they throw a dagger at the messenger's feet and then say, oh my God, a dagger fell out of his tunic. He must have come around to kill me. And then send off a load of men and a couple of gladiators around to Agrippina's house to finish her off, basically. They are panicking that she will realise that this has been an attempt on her life and that she will have contacted people in Rome and be arranging a coup. So they think there's a very real possibility that she will have the Praetorian Guard on the way to knock off Nero to save herself. As it turns out, she's just sitting at home feeling sorry for herself. And according to Tacitus, when they arrive and kind of force their way into her home, and she's sitting in her bedroom, and she says, if you're here for my son, you can tell him I'm fine. If you're here to murder me, then I don't believe you came from my son.
That's really disappointing. Yeah.
And they reply by cracking her on the head with a sword. And she goes down and then she gets back up again and says, all right, if you're going to murder me, stab me here, and points to her womb. And they do. And then she dies. They then leave and go back to Nero and say it's all over. She doesn't get a funeral of any kind. She is cremated by members of her household in her own back garden. She doesn't get like a proper bier or anything. She is just on a dining room couch. And then her ashes are buried just by the side of the road and immediately lost.
Wow.
Yeah.
So does Rome fall for this? Does Rome buy that there was an attempt on her life from...
Everybody goes along with it because they're all a bunch of cowards, basically. So Nero sends back a letter and says, oh, my mum tried to kill me, so I killed her. If you could just have a ceremony of thanksgiving and take all her statues down, that would be great. And everybody grumbles a lot and does exactly that. There is a partial solar eclipse during the ceremony of thanksgiving, which really freaks everybody out because they think it's the gods frowning upon them.
Yeah.
Nero then avoids Rome for quite a long time and also avoids Bay because he claims it's haunted by his mother. So at the very least, he feels a bit bad about it. And then he has this really conflicted relationship with her memory whereby he still wants to celebrate her birthday. So he still has like games and things on her birthday, but doesn't want anyone to actually be nice about her.
There's a play that is written not long after she dies, about 10 years after she dies.
The Octavia, yeah.
She's a character in that haunting him, essentially,
yeah.
isn't she?
She appears and tells Octavia and everyone all about how she died. In that version, which is like the most contemporary version, the boat is just an old boat and they get a smaller boat to ram it, which makes a lot more sense than one that collapses. But yeah, she appears and is a kind of tragic figure who tells her story and tries to save Octavia. Because yeah. Octavia is seen as this very, very tragic princess. Should have been great, but got stuck being married to Nero instead.
Yeah, so being 10 years after all those events, I kind of want to think that there's a lot of truth in that play.
Yeah, it's certainly closer to what, you know, people were saying at the time about her than the things that Tacitus is writing about her in Suetonius. Tacitus's version of Agrippina is that she is the great kind of big bad of his story. His story in the annals is that the Julio-Claudians were a degrading force in Rome, that they were eroding everything that was good about Romanness, that the height of that degradation was Agrippina having a public face and having public position, that she is the greatest example of how bad it got under the Julio-Claudians, basically.
Yeah, yeah. The flip side of that, though, is that he directly says that he used her own writings as background.
Yeah.
As far as I know, this is the only example of a woman writing her own biography, if that's what he's referring to. Is that about right? What's your perspective on this?
So she writes her own biography. We have two extracts from it, like two little things that we know are in it. One is in Pliny the Elder. One is in Tacitus. It's basically, she writes what's called a commentary, which is a genre of writing, which is specifically for writing about war and politics. But she wrote it about the trials and tribulations of her family. Mm. So from Julia on downwards, basically. And there were a lot of trials and tribulations in fairness. Like, it was not a family that fared well. And the two extracts that we have are genuinely fascinating because one is her writing about how Nero was a breech birth. So her experience of labor, which is unique as far as I am aware. And the second is her writing about her mother, where her mum has this really difficult 15-year period after her father has died, where she hates Tiberius with every fibre of her being, and Tiberius hates her with every fibre of their being, but they have to hang out a lot.
Mm.
And they're constantly fighting, but also have to spend all of their time together. There is this point when Agrippina the Elder is about 40, where she asks Tiberius permission to remarry. She says she's ill and she is tired and she is lonely, and she has Tiberius come round and she cries and she says, I want a husband, basically. And Tiberius says, no, he won't let her. And then he just leaves. And it is this very, very vulnerable moment that is not something that you see from Agrippina the Elder in other sources. At her lowest, like crying and asking for a husband. Those are the only two bits that we know that she wrote about, but it suggests that it was a very personal and very intimate, like talking about her giving birth, very intimate memoir of her family written in the style of Julius Caesar's Conquest of Gaul.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, Claudius gets a lot of kudos for being the historian of the family who wrote quite a lot. And I mean, part of that is, you know, a Robert Graves haze over him as well. But you never hear about Agrippina having written anything. But the fact that Tacitus referred to it and Pliny referred to it as well makes it really interesting. It also kind of makes me think, okay, so Tacitus is referring to it. So does that make Tacitus's account of Agrippina's life and her various, you know, nefarious actions believable? Does that make
quite
sense?
Possibly, yeah. At the very least, like, he had access to what she thought about these things. He obviously wasn't particularly sympathetic to what she thought about these things. And he is very interested in a literary style. Like, you can tell from the way he writes about the deaths of Nero, Claudius even, and Augustus, that he is interested in fitting things into a narrative that is more important than what actually happened. But he was there reading them. There was just no way of knowing how much it filtered in, unfortunately.
That would be great to have a hold of.
Yeah, everyone has their secret little list of things that they wish will turn up in the Herculaneum Library. Tacitus's lost books would be super useful, but Agrippina's memoir would be amazing.
So in the modern day, with the lack of her autobiography sitting on her shelves or anything like that, how is Agrippina thought of? Do we think of her through the lens of Tacitus exclusively, or are there more elements in there now?
The way that she is remembered is through the lens of Robert Graves, to be honest. Obviously, he's written a novel, which then is a TV show that is strongly drawing on Suetonius over Tacitus, but on those ancient sources in a very uncritical way. And he tells a great story, but when you tell people that you've written a book about Agrippina the Younger, or you are interested in Agrippina the Younger, or mention her, they will say, oh, she's a scheming, murderous tyrant. And largely what they're imagining is I, Claudius, where she is a scheming, murdering tyrant who is an agent of chaos and is slightly terrifying. that does largely come from Tacitus, but what people are talking about is the Robert Graves version.
But that's not the Agrippina that you've been describing to me this evening. No. I also get the impression that you see her not even remotely as an agent of chaos, but as agent of order.
I do. I see her very much as an agent of stability and as someone who I don't think that Claudius would have been anywhere near as long-lasting as emperor without her. I think that if she hadn't had the force of personality that she had, that there would have been another successful coup against him and we would have had a different version of history. And I don't think that you would have had any decent years of Nero, really, without her either. Everyone always says it's Seneca, but Seneca survives her and he doesn't have that much of an influence. Like, you have a stable empire, and I do think that she was, as much as she is very, very good at spectacle and drawing attention when she wants attention, I think her greatest strength is her ability to do the behind-the-scenes diplomacy and negotiation that needs to be done to run a successful, widely spread empire with hundreds and hundreds of moving parts.
That's historian and author Dr. Emma Southen, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. Applicable to this podcast, she's the author of the book Agrippina, Empress, Exile, Hustler, Whore, and her new book is A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. She's also the co-host of the podcast History is Sexy, which I heartily recommend. As for this podcast, if you enjoyed it, and I hope you did if you got this far, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are, as always, very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Emma Southen is at Nuclear Teeth, I'm at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome, so until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.